University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents independent scholar Leila Shanks and her lecture, Survival Strategies for Living in the 21st Century. Shanks' lecture will examine all aspects of living in an increasingly diverse and global society and present four primary strategies for survival: rethinking everything, soaking up all the diversity you can find, accepting responsibility for yourself and others, and beginning to develop an inner life. A longtime Lincoln resident, Shanks has been described as a source of strength and encouragement to countless women, regardless of age, race, creed, or color, and as a role model as a homemaker and professional, as well as a leader and organizer. A leader in the fight for civil rights and desegregated schools, she was involved with the Congress on Racial Equality and the panel of American women during the early stages of the civil rights movement. Shanks was instrumental in helping the YWCA become more inclusive and responsive to women of color, and in 1989 was the recipient of a YWCA Tribute to Women Award. A former regional director for the Nebraska Department of Labor, she has conducted workshops on aging at Nebraska Women of Color conferences. A scholar for the Nebraska Committee for the Humanities, Shanks frequently speaks on such subjects as Black Women, Achievements Against the Odds, and Black Scientists and Inventors. Join us now for University Forum and Leila Shanks.
Good morning. I'm always amazed when you live in a town and people who actually know you will recommend you to come and talk. You know, people are most often from somewhere else, and that's probably why. So I'm especially happy to be here. I think it's a real honor and a privilege. I understand I have 50 minutes, and since I'm a Virgo, you'll know you can count on me to the minute. Survival strategies for living in the 21st century. These strategies are intended for a lifetime. We are not made yet. We are constantly in the making. And if at some point all of this seems too much, just remember that this is intended for a lifetime. I hope to challenge you this morning, to challenge you to expand yourselves, to stretch yourselves. There are literally worlds of self-discovery and learning just waiting for the taking, even for people of my age. It was not the comfortable people of the world who made the contributions to our civilization that you and I are benefiting from today. It was the people who refused to be satisfied with the status quo as the best we could do. People who were willing to pull away from the herd and to look adversity and fears in the eye and to stand alone when necessary. People who were willing to endure the pain to bring the human race forward. Your generation, without a doubt, has to be a special generation, because there are few generations that live to experience not only the changing of the century, but the changing of the millennium. And you know, we make a big deal about the changing of the new year. So this is an event that happens only once every 1,000 years. So by any accounts, this has to be an epochal and a special and an exhilarating time to be alive, despite all of the suffering and the misery and the anguish and the hunger and the death and the cruelties here at home and throughout the world. Some futurists say that the closer we get to the changing of the millennium, that everybody goes a little crazy. And perhaps that explains why, during this presidential election, that some people confused Murphy Brown and that family that reminds me of the Flintstones, the Simpsons. Perhaps that's why some people confuse those cartoon characters with real live people. Some of you may have heard comedians speculate that the next thing we know, one of the presidential candidates will be trying to get a doctor's appointment with Doogie Howser. At any rate, events tell us that we are in a period of transition and transformation all over the world. We are now told that it takes only one small country manufacturing without emission controls to deplete the ozone layer for the entire planet. We are now faced with the question, can our environment sustain a global economy? Some have described the world as in the throes of a nervous breakdown. Everything is shifting and changing, being redefined. All kinds of groups are emerging and maneuvering for positions and new roles without really knowing what these new roles are, because we don't have a roadmap or a textbook that we can look up what comes next. We are like pioneers and frontiers people. Today, by the time a product reaches the market, it's already obsolete. There is no question that our technology has far outstripped our inner ability to keep up with the changes. Ethically, we are possibly 25 or more years behind in using biological technology, even though it's available to us today. From virtual reality for training surgeons to my optic fibers for beaming instantly into our homes, the movie and the entertainment of our choice. This is what we have today. Our institutions that once served as our external anchors are unable to keep up with the changes. They have to be pushed and prodded and pulled even to catch up with yesterday. What used to be right is now wrong. Greed is now acceptable. Even the word bad means good. And we're not just in a period of transition and transformation nationally and internationally, but we're in a period of crisis personally and individually. I'm sure I don't need to tell you about the changing roles of males and females. When I was a girl growing up in a place called Green Pastures, Oklahoma, tradition said that a woman's place was in the home. But it's estimated by the year 1995 that 64% of all women will work outside the home. Lifestyles have changed. The makeup of the family has changed. Some are calling for the return to the good old days and the values and traditions of those good old days. But those good old days didn't represent value or good for a lot of us Americans. In my own case, I had to spend two-thirds of my life living under legal American-style apartheid. Just imagine that. I had to spend two-thirds of my life living at a time when racial segregation was the law of the land. That was the law. It was legal. And to those values and traditions, I say good riddance. That old world we knew is gone. But how can we find our way into the future without those comfortable traditions and those old landmarks that we relied on? I want to share the first of four survival strategies for your consideration. And these strategies are not new. I'm sure they've been said in many different ways throughout human history. They overlap and interlap. And of course, in the final analysis, only you can decide whether any of this has relevance for your life. The first strategy is be open to learning a new way of thinking, a new way of looking at everything. The writer Nikki Giovanni says, rethink everything. Nothing is sacred. There is nothing that cannot be discussed, unquote. With the collapse of communism and the electronic media, especially the fax machine, everything is being discussed. It is as if the whole world has turned into one giant talk show. Computerization has made all of our lives an open book. The changes brought about by technology demand that we reassess and reevaluate everything, especially our sense of values and traditions. This includes our concept of the American dream. Every day we see people on television telling how the American dream has turned into a nightmare for them. This should tell us something. What would make us think that the American dream would, could, or should remain the same for all generations? What would make us think that your generation would hold to the same concept of the American dream as a generation 25 or 50 or 50 years ago? As human beings, we're constantly changing and evolving. And since each generation is different, each has the responsibility to define for itself what the American dream shall be for that generation. During this presidential campaign, we've heard a lot about the need for jobs. Every week, thousands of people are losing their jobs. All over the world, in different parts, there's a shortage of jobs. Futurists tell us that this whole concept of work, jobs, and careers has to change. We have to look at it differently. Automation demands this, but it also opens up many new creative possibilities. One of the concepts for you to think about is not where you're going to find a job when you graduate, but how you can create your own job when you graduate. Telecommunications makes it possible for some people even now to work half-time in the workplace and half-time from their computers at home. More and more people are spending all of their time working from their computers in their homes. There are also Americans who are looking to going to other countries to find jobs. People are now contracting their skills and their professional services rather than looking to a regular salary. There is participatory democracy in the workplace. There is worker ownership of the workplace. And of course, there's flex time and there's job sharing. These are all alternatives to graduating and going out expecting someone else to give you a job. Workers of the future should be open also to having several careers in a lifetime. Several careers in a lifetime. A few years ago, we kept our 3-year-old grandson, Orpheus, for a month. And Orpheus's response to every new idea reminded me a great deal of myself. Every time I said something to Orpheus that he had not heard before, he said, "No, that's not right. That's not what my mommy says. That's not the way she does it." If he had not heard it in his lifetime of 3 years, then it wasn't possible. It couldn't work and it wouldn't happen. We Americans think a lot like Orpheus. Despite our living in a democracy where we are free to think, we often lock ourselves in to a kind of rigid absolutism, a kind of authoritarianism that closes us off from our greatest resource, our creativity. Our immediate response to a new idea is usually, "Oh, that won't work," even before we hear it. We limit ourselves to a pattern of thinking that says it has to be either this way or that way. We heard a lot of that during this campaign this fall. Rather than thinking, let's come up with a new idea that has not even been thought of before. We really need to focus on the fact that creativity did not die with the founding fathers. The day may come in your lifetime when our Constitution needs to be rewritten. South Africa is trying to get the parties together today, right now, to try to rewrite a new Constitution. Canada just voted down a new Constitution. No doubt free enterprise with its exploitation and its greed is going to have to be improved in order to survive in the next century. Even our democracy needs to be revisited. Who among us would presume to already know that there isn't a new form of government, a new economic system for the future that we don't even know about yet? When my husband Hughes was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease about 7 years ago, at the time of the diagnosis, the clinicians told me, "You can never expect to have any kind of a normal life again." And as I sat there listening to them, I thought to myself, "You don't have the slightest idea of what you're talking about." And I set about to find a better way, a new way of living with an Alzheimer's patient. And I continue to find that there is no end to creativity when we dare to think the unthinkable. A whole new world of creative solutions to seemingly impossible problems opens up when we release ourselves from our self-imposed prisons in the mind. In the process, we learn to literally regroove our brains. Another area we Americans need to rethink is our concept of, quote, doing good, unquote. Paul Tillich, the theologian, says that the doing is in the being. The year we kept our children out of school to protest racial segregation in the courts, there were several teachers, all white, who came from the University of Kansas City over 15 miles that whole 9 months, 2 and 3 days a week, to help us teach our 9 students in our school. And at the end of the school year, I was talking to one of the English professors who was particularly faithful. And I couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, he began to tell me that he had no intention of ever sending his children to school with black children, that he had no intention of ever living in a neighborhood where there were black people, even if he himself could select the families. We were his project, as it were. We were where he came to do good. But he had no intention of giving up his lifelong held inner prejudices that continue to keep institutionalized injustices in place. This won't work in the 90s and into the next century. This leads to the second survival strategy. Soak up every aspect of diversity that you can find. Since we now live in a global village, it is important to break out of our complacency. We Americans, you know, have a kind of smugness about us. But it's important to get an accurate picture of the makeup of the world's population. North America makes up only 5.1% of the world's total population, and this includes Canada. What used to be the Soviet Union makes up only 5.4%, and Europe makes up only 9.3%. This leaves 4/5 of the world populated by peoples of color. In the next century, the person who interviews you for a job, or the person to whom you are assigned to share an office, or the person you may have to contact for your business could be a person from any religion, from any ethnic group, from any racial group, from any in any physical condition, and from any lifestyle orientation. A young friend of mine who is African American was recently sent to Fargo, North Dakota as the state manager for IBM, and none of his employees were peoples of color. And those employees who were still hanging on to feelings of superiority to African Americans had a hard time keeping their jobs. Unfortunately, we have made a god out of biological race in America. Think about it. We've made a god out of biological race, and I'm speaking of all races, all races. We have made it the whole of who we are. And in so doing, we have lost our way to finding our own individual identity. We've lost our way to finding our own personal diversity and uniqueness as a human being. And I think we've done this for so long, because this is tradition, and we've done this for so long that it's not even conscious anymore. And this is why we must become conscious, because it's so insidious and so dangerous. And the alternative is not in pretending biological race does not exist. The alternative is seeing it for what it is, one and only one part of the whole of who we are. One would think that the first time we encountered diversity was when we met a person of a different color. But what is more diverse than our relatives? I want to challenge you with this question. Is it really more difficult to try to get along with a person from a different race and a different culture than it is to try to get along with your closest relatives? I once asked a group of college students, how many of you would like to have your mothers living next door to you? Not a hand went up. And I don't think it's because they all didn't like their mother. Some of them may not have. But it was because we are individuals. We are born as an individual, not as members in groups. And we're different even from our own mothers, with our own personalities, with our own lifestyles. And believe it or not, it is even possible for you now as young adults to see your parents for what they really are. And that's individuals first, just vulnerable human beings, even as you and I. They are not really mothers and fathers first. They're persons first. And when we can see our parents in that way, it opens up a whole new world of communicating with them. Whenever we find ourselves relating to individuals as a group or as an assigned category, we have lost touch with our own individuality and with our own humanity. One might speculate that at some time in our human evolution that we needed the security of only being around people who outwardly resembled us. But now events are pushing us to move on into the next stage and phase of our human evolution where we have to leave the comforts of biological race, as it were, and join the whole human race. The gift of diversity is in finding that common thread in yourself that runs throughout all humanity and links us one with the other. As a practical matter, right now, here at Wesleyan, begin to learn other languages, other religions. While Christianity is the single largest religion in the world, all the other religions put together, there are twice as many people of other religions, with Islam being the fastest growing religion throughout the world. Learn about other cultures. This can awaken a new sense of respect in you. Learn about other people's art and music so that we can get beyond making fun of sounds that are different. The literature and other of other peoples, especially biographies and autobiographies, are great resources. You have to accept the responsibility of educating yourself on diversity because you're going to live at a time when you have to be a citizen of the world. As one writer puts it, we give our children history. See, when you learned history, you got it with all of the blood washed out of it. Now it's time to get the whole story. And you're going to have to do that job for yourself. Someday at Wesleyan, there will probably be a required course, a complete discipline, where students are required to learn a smattering of several languages, several religions, several cultures. We can no longer afford to limit ourselves to one language when the whole world is learning at a minimum two languages. Is it not arrogant and foolhardy to expect everybody to be able to speak our language? Think about that. Right here in Lincoln, Nebraska, at Lincoln High School, there are students that speak 20 languages from 20 different countries. In the city of Los Angeles, there are students in the public school systems that speak 120 languages. Recently, when I talked to an adult Sunday school class about Alzheimer's disease, afterwards an older woman, and of course at my age every woman is older, but I do think she was a little older, and she was especially warm to me. She came up, she shook my hand, she touched me, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm a volunteer at where your husband goes to daycare. I take him to daycare several days a week." And she said, "I'm going to be sure and go over and say hi to him." And I said, "Oh, he'll like that, because he's still very friendly and very warm." And so two or three days later, the staff told me that she did come in and she asked for Hughes. And when Hughes was pointed out to her, she jumped back and she said, "He's black, he's black," and turned and fled. Most likely, this woman had lived over 70 years and had never in her lifetime gone up to a man who was black and spoken to him. And so now, in the twilight of her life, she was unable to go up to a demented and harmless, warm and gentle man and extend her hand and say, "Hi, Hughes, how are you?" How difficult would that be for some of us today? She could accept him being demented. That was okay. But she couldn't accept him being black. To take it a step further, how difficult would it be for us to go up and just extend our hands to an AIDS patient? The third survival strategy is accept the dual nature of our responsibilities. As human beings, there are two primary responsibilities that we have in life. And the first one we're all familiar with, at least intellectually, if not practically. And that is the responsibility for ourselves. And the second one is our responsibility to the group, since we live in a civilized, organized society. I heard someone say the other day that when Tokyo burps, the whole world gets indigestion. But let's first consider our responsibility for ourselves. Here again, we can learn something from Orpheus. When Orpheus was 3, and he did something he shouldn't have done, it was always somebody else's fault. It was always somebody else's responsibility. Somebody made him do it. When he got angry, somebody made him mad. When we are 3, we don't have the consciousness to know that our feelings can only originate in us. They can only come out of us. When I talk to young children, I always ask them, "Can anybody fit themselves inside your head? Can they get inside your head and make you do something?" And they all look puzzled and they giggle, but they shout, "No." But young and old, all of us still keep trying, pretty much, don't we? And in abdicating responsibility for our feelings and for our actions, what we really do is surrender our lives to those we blame. In many respects, the 80s and the 90s, in those years, we began to sound a lot like a nation of victims and excuses. It was really an uncomfortable moment for me one time when I realized I couldn't use Hughes having Alzheimer's as an excuse for my behavior. I was really disappointed because I thought, what a perfect excuse. But deep down, we all have an inner way of knowing that there really are no excuses. Because when we give an excuse, we're saying, I don't exist. I'm a non-person because I'm not responsible. Anytime you turn on a television show today, there is always someone telling of their victimization. People from every strata of our society, from the inner city to the suburbs to the White House, from the corporate America to Congress. This has been a time when it has always been somebody else's fault. Some people have called it our Teflon era, as you probably heard. And this is not intended to deny the real sufferings in the world and the injustices and the inequalities that are still rampant in America. Neither is it intended to trivialize what society calls tragedies that come unwanted and unexpected into all of our lives at some time. But it is to say that when we accept the responsibilities for our feelings and for our actions, that we discover we have a choice. You see, we have a choice as to how we shall internalize these events that come into our lives. It is we who decide whether we shall be victims of circumstances and thus lead lives of tragedy, or whether we shall seize these circumstances and make opportunities out of them to realize our greatest potential. The choice is ours. At the same time, we do not live in a vacuum. And as members in a so-called civilized and organized society, we have a responsibility to the group. And we are inextricably interconnected and interlinked, whether we like it or not. The time when we could think of what was called rugged individualism in our country's history, where it said, I got mine, now you get yours, that time is really gone. The bombardment of images from television and other electronic media have influenced peoples everywhere to clamor for freedom and a better way of life. And the day when the haves could live unencumbered and undisturbed next to the have-nots, that day is gone. European countries are now being plundered. European countries that once plundered the continents of Africa and Asia and India, they are now themselves being invaded by people from these very continents. They are called immigrants. And the neo-Nazis notwithstanding, they continue to come, much like the Mexicans across our borders. South Africa has also found that with all of their cougarans and all of their diamonds, they couldn't build walls high enough or thick enough to keep out their 25 million fellow South Africans clamoring for a better quality of life. Closer to home are our inner cities, all but abandoned in the 80s and in the 90s, as if they were on some distant planet. But the problems there are now next door and in the suburbs and in rural America. In the words of the Negro spiritual, there is no hiding place down here. As Americans, we were willing to take the primary responsibility and the leadership of spending billions to go thousands of miles away to help rich Kuwait, not to mention the lives lost of Americans and the thousands upon thousands of lives of Iraqians that we killed. We are willing to help the Bosnians, but we are still unwilling to help the people in the inner cities here at home. And until the poorest child in the so-called ghettos of America, until the poorest child is free to walk to school free from a sniper's bullet, no child in America is safe. The problems in the inner cities are just human problems. They are no more unsolvable than the human problems of peoples anywhere else in the world. What we lack as Americans is the leadership and the will to face them and to solve them. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, we will either learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will die apart as fools. The fourth and final survival strategy is begin now. Begin now to develop your own inner life. The development of your inner life will probably determine more than anything else the quality of your survival in the next century. My dear teacher told me many years ago, Leela, we go out to change the world because we don't have the guts to change ourselves. The writer Sharon Farris says, as a human species, we have evolved physically. Physically, we've evolved. But we are still in prehistoric times when it comes to our inner development. How often do we even consider that we live in two worlds, the outer world of the physical and the material, and the inner world of the mind, the soul, and the spirit? Often we keep our inner world unconscious, ignoring it, except in times of death and great crisis. We never even consider anything about our spirit or our soul, do we? Until we have a huge problem, when we're starving our lives of this resource that's available to us every day. Each one of us here is a living, breathing dynamo with unlimited inner resources of creativity and ingenuity for facing any change, any challenge, any problem. But each one of us has to access this inner resource for ourselves. One writer speaks of it as suffering through to our own maturity. No amount of wealth or fame or social position can give it to us. Neither can our biological race. Neither can our parents give it to us, or our sororities, or our fraternities, or our great connections, or neither can our ministers, or our teachers, or our counselors. It is really ours for the taking. We just have to do it for ourselves. Some speak of the inner life as the core of our being, as our center. And it is this center that connects us to the source, to the power, to the creator of all life. I would not presume to know what speaks to another's heart and soul, but it is through our philosophy, or through our religious beliefs, or through our faith, that our inner life becomes anchored and reinforced. the more we become conscious of this gift of life within, the more we understand who we are and why we are here. It is through our inner life that we finally begin to become connected to ourselves and thus to others. That's where all of these parts come together, and we begin to understand what it means to be whole, to be a whole person. It usually takes a lot of pain to drive us to our core. The events that we call tragedies, like Alzheimer's disease and cancer, these are the very circumstances that life sends us to extract our greatest and our best from us. Our inner life is always our permanent home. That's your permanent home that nobody has the power to come in and take away from you. It is a place to which you can always return. Depending upon your beliefs and your faith, we can develop a daily discipline for the nourishment and the development of our inner life, not just in times of trouble. Here is where all of our strengths are generated that we need for facing the future in the next century. There is a strength, especially for young people, of self-acceptance. Self-acceptance just as you are. So often, we deny ourselves self-acceptance, waiting for that magic moment of perfection, which means that we never will, because we are always in the making. But operating from our centers now, right here, we can find the courage of self-acceptance of our imperfect selves, and then the courage to begin this lifelong process of deep inner change. They are the strengths of patience, of endurance, of perseverance, which you've shown a lot of this morning. The strengths for determination, of forgiveness, of faith, of respect, of hope, and for ultimate joy. Every outer action is first preceded by an inner action. Carry with you away from this place into the future the awareness that your internal strengths and resources are infinite for facing any difficulty, any fear, any change, any crises, any challenge. It is our internal strengths and resources. It is our inner life that will finally transform us and thus the world. Thank you very much.
Today's speaker on University Forum was independent scholar Layla Shanks. Her lecture was entitled Survival Strategies for Living in the 21st Century. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.